Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
You know, it's like trimming your toenails while you're losing a limb. And I'm not denigrating any. I'm denigrating the religion industry.
Welcome, everybody, to the Guy James Show today. I'm ready and raring to go, and I hope you are as well. So much to talk about, but what a day. What a day. Stock market's down 300 points. Oil's up $5. Hit $140 a barrel just a little bit ago. Oh, man. Oh, man. And I see Ben Bernanke and Warren Buffett are arguing over whether or not we have inflation or not. I'll tell you what, if there's going to be a bet, I'll put my money on Warren as far as who knows what's going to happen. I'll gladly put my money on Warren Buffett if there's any argument whatsoever going on with all of that. Got a great guest coming up at the bottom of this hour. Got Michael Waldman. And for those of you who don't know who Michael Waldman is, Michael Waldman was the main speechwriter for Bill Clinton, the director of speech writing. He wrote his inaugural addresses. He wrote his State of the Union speeches. And he's got a new book out called A Return to Common Sense, which is really a very, very fine book. And we're going to have Michael on coming up at the bottom of this hour. You'll enjoy that. So call all your friends, tell them to hook up right away, and tune in to the Guy James Show. Okay, got that? We expect to have at least 700,000 or 800,000 people on line by then. Yeah, really. Oh, my, 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 my. Yes, the stock market, oh, it's making a comeback. Now it's down only 286 points. Who knows? Maybe there'll be a great big, everybody will start buying here at the end. It'll go back up again and shoot that oil down. At 139.55 a barrel right now, oil, that ought to bring gas up another, what, 10 cents? They say for every dollar a barrel should go up 2 cents. Mm-hmm. Such good news. So much fun to go out and fill up the old automobile these days, isn't it? God. Sad thing to have to do. All sorts of things going on in the news. We've got hearings going on in the House. We've got Supreme Court. Hey, well, what a good day to be owning a gun shop in Washington, D.C., huh? You never know what this court's going to do, do you? I mean, you can kind of plan on it, but... I don't think there are any gun stores in Washington, D.C., but if there were, I'd love to have one today because they'll be selling handguns by the truckload in Washington, D.C. Not that they probably haven't been buying them in Virginia and New York and any other place they can get their hands on them anyway, but it's legal. The Supreme Court said, hell, everybody have a handgun. Nah, go ahead. Carry one, you know, two holsters like Gene Autry did and Roy Rogers. Carry a couple of them. Everybody put them on. Every man, woman, and child in Washington, D.C., and forget Washington, D.C., all over the country, everybody buy yourself some handguns. Yes, sir, you need them for protection. Because they're after you. Who's after you? Hey, it doesn't matter who's after you. They're after you, so you need some guns and buy plenty of ammo. Get that armor piercing ammo while you're at it. Don't fool around. This is the kind that goes right through the bulletproof vest and all that. I think they make a, you know. So get the good stuff. Don't screw around. If you're going to have a handgun, make sure you buy a good one. I tell you the truth, I wouldn't know one handgun from another. I know the name Smith & Wesson. Let me see. Remington. I don't know. I can't think of any others. I don't know much about guns, to tell you the truth. But I do know they're going to be shooting them up in Washington tonight because it's now legal to own yourself a handgun. The Supreme Court says so. One more time. I think there ought to be that little building out back of the Washington, out of the... outside of the Supreme Court, the Court of Common Sense. I don't know. And then yesterday they had that the ruling that the death penalty in Louisiana was not constitutional, death penalty for child rapists. Now I know the right's having a really rip-snorter of a fit today. They're going nuts over that. Just going nuts over that. And, hey, who likes child rapists? Nobody. They're the scourge, the lowest form of humanity as far as I'm concerned. The very worst. There isn't anybody worse. Well, maybe Dick Cheney. I do mean that. Anyway, they're making all this ruckus over this ruling yesterday. It's just not right, you know. You gotta execute these guys. You gotta do that. You know how many people have been executed for child rape over these past 20, 30, 40 years? None that I can find. None. So what's the big deal? You know, they come up with all the stories. Yeah, well, what about that poor little girl and all that? Well, hey, yeah, horrible. Horrible. But there haven't been any cases, I don't think, of actual execution of child rapists over the past 40, 50 years that I can find. I could be wrong on that. But I don't think so. And besides that, not only in open society is he considered the scourge of humanity, in prison, they're the bottom of the totem pole. So a guy like that most likely won't even last very long in prison. I don't know what the big deal is. Why everybody got all cranked up over that? I really don't. I did get several dozen emails agreeing with me about the politicians giving up their pay during a campaign. Several folks said they also thought they ought to give up their seats in Congress. But I got to give the prize to Stewart. Stewart had the best line of the day, saying he'd be willing to pay them two or three times what they get paid not to show up. Good point, Stewart. I like that. I really did. And the gas thing going on today, let me see. It's, where is it? It's, well, it's slipped. It's only $139.55 a barrel right now. But what we need to do, and what I want to do is set up on the show, and some of you work on the mechanics of this. We got to get this set up. Let's get up a pool to see which of us can more accurately predict how high the price of gasoline will go up between now and maybe next year at this time, or maybe only 6 months from now. Maybe make it Christmas or Thanksgiving or somewhere around there. Be thinking about that, how we can get a good contest going. We can all chip in a buck, and the winner takes all. Maybe you win enough to buy a gallon of gas or something, you know? And I want to say one thing. I'm not gonna elaborate on it. I'm going to say one thing about one person right now. That's all I got to say about him. Ralph Nader is a clown. Absolutely a clown. Ralph Nader. That's it. That's all I'm going to talk about Ralph Nader today. I promised myself that I wouldn't get going on that. Most of you know how I feel about Ralph Nader. Anyway, speaking of clowns, you also know how I feel about Glenn Beck. Yesterday on his radio show, Glenn Beck expressed his disdain of the recent Supreme Court ruling granting terror suspects the right to challenge their detention in civil courts, the habeas corpus ruling. And Beck said, we ought to shoot them all. Just shoot them all. Doesn't matter if there's several of them who have been innocent and we've let them go because we knew they were innocent. I don't know how many, but a couple of dozen, I think, have been let go because they were, in fact, innocent. But Glenn Beck, whether they're innocent or not, just wants to shoot them all, wants to shoot them in the head. That's what he said on the show. Here's what he had to say about shooting them. Let's just shoot them all. Shoot them.
Joe, I mean, I'm saying this in jest, but it really is that, isn't it? I mean, it's really, it's going down that road, isn't it? Holy cow, Joe just said this decision is frightening when you read the language. This court has done some frightening, frightening things. With Guantanamo, gang, I got news for you. We're in deep trouble with Guantanamo.
Glenn Beck talks about frightening. Some of the things this dumbass has said, and he talks about frightening. I cannot believe that him and Michael Savage, the two of them, are still on the air. I don't know of any two people more offensive that ever have been on the radio than Michael Savage and Glenn Beck. I can't imagine. Let's continue with this insanity.
Well, we can't do this. We're going to give these guys access to our courts. Let me say something. If I were president of the United States, I would go on national television and say, ladies and gentlemen of America, the Supreme Court said that we don't have Guantanamo, so that is over. We're going to release all of them, but I want you to know from here on out, our policy is to not have prisoners. We're going to shoot them all in the head. If we think that they are against us, we're going to shoot them and kill them, period. Because that's the only thing we've got going for us, is we can put them away and get information. If we can't put them away and they're going to use our court system, kill them.
Kill them, Glenn. Kill them, Glenn. It doesn't matter if they're guilty or not. Just kill them. Never mind the ones that we've let go because they're innocent. Never mind that Al-Qaeda could probably not have to recruit anybody themselves ever again because we're doing it for them. Never mind that. Never mind the consequences to our own soldiers. Never mind any of that. Kill them. What does it matter if we mix in a few innocent ones? Shoot them all. The guy is a madman, Glenn Beck. He is just a madman. Him and Savage ought to hook up together on a show. I don't know what we'd call it, Looney and Looney Tunes, whatever. Both of them are nuts. And for anybody to make a statement like Glenn Beck made on that, yeah, there's just something the hell wrong with him. I got a lot of statements today that are just wild. I got one by Orrin Hatch. I'm sure you saw that. And of course, We have this internet neutrality thing going on, the FISA rule and all. And God only knows how that's going to end up. I shouldn't say it that way. Really, I think we all know how it's going to end up. I think it's going to end up that the Democrats and anybody who reveres their freedom and their right to privacy in this country is going to eat it. I think that's what's going to happen. I don't see any other way out of it. 80 to 15 on the vote to close for cloture on that last night. 80 to 15. I looked at that and I thought, this can't be. No, the Democrats have talked a better game in this. This cannot be. And what do we find out? We find out we've got 15 people. 15. And the United States Senate, Democrats, out of what, 50? 51, actually. Well, don't count Lieberman, that's son of a... okay. So we got Biden, Boxer, Brown, Cantwell, Dodd, Durbin, Feingold, Harkin, Kerry, Lautenberg, Leahy, Menendez, Saunders, independent, not actually even a Democrat, but he votes with us most of the time, Schumer and Wyden. Those are the people. 15. Only 15 who know what the Constitution of the United States really means. And of course, Barack Obama wasn't on that list. He was out campaigning. Couldn't be bothered with it, I guess. I know it wouldn't have mattered anyway. But it sickened me, and I don't know how this shoots, sits at the very moment. Maybe he's changed his mind on it. Maybe you remember yesterday or Tuesday, I said I think we're going to find out what kind of a man Barack Obama is this week. And you know, I've thrown my support behind Barack Obama heart and soul, ready to fight it out for him. But I said at the beginning of this week, we're going to find out what kind of a man Barack Obama is this week. And he makes this statement, the bill has changed, so I don't think the security threats have changed. I think the security threats are similar. My view on FISA has always been that the issue of the phone companies per se is not one that overrides the security interest of the American people. Okay. All right. Is that how he's going to keep it? Is that how he's going to keep it? I only hope that he changes his mind. I hope he takes a different tact on this. Democrats can't even do a filibuster when they should filibuster. And they can't even make the Republicans filibuster when they've tried it and said they're going to just threaten to do it, what, 58, 60 times? I don't know how many, about 60 I think it is. Threatened this filibuster. And the Democrats have a chance to do an actual filibuster on something. What do? They cave. They cave again. And again. And again. Damn it. Why just allow the corporations to break the law in this telecom immunity? Why just let them do it? Why not get rid of the EPA and let the big corporations start polluting the air until it's black again? Why not just let, you know, make it so Lake Erie will light up on fire again, the Cuyahoga River? Why not just do away with the law? Why not let everybody violate the law? We let the telecom companies do it. Yeah, but they were cooperating with the President of the United States, and the President of the United States says it's legal, then it's legal. Oh, my God. Is that the way it's going to be? Is that how it's going to be? Are we going to have some sort of a national surveillance state, and we're going to have neighbors turning in neighbors, and you know, we've seen all that before. not here, but other places. How much power do they want the President of the United States to have? How much power do they really want him to have? We're going to talk a lot about that today. Do both parties want him to have all this power? I think so, evidently. And if so, why? Why does the legislative branch of both parties believe that it's okay for the executive branch to cut the legislative branch's balls off? Huh? Why do they both feel that way? Let's just have an imperial presidency and let's just let them go for it and get as much power as you possibly can in the White House, and we'll be irrelevant. We can just come and collect our paychecks every day in the Congress. How do you feel about that? Set over to the phone. Hi, you're on the Guy James Show.
Hi, Guy.
Yes.
Are we on the air?
Yes.
Oh, it's Sandra. How you doing?
Hi, Sandra.
Listen, the whole Pfizer thing, you know, I can't even believe, you know, how venal it is because, you know, how are they making it out that the Fourth Amendment isn't as important as this so-called threat?
Uh-huh.
And Obama, like I said, I'll vote for him because I'm not going to vote for McCain, but I'm sort of really disturbed by his position, especially his comment about, oh, I promise, basically, to be a good president, so I won't do that. I'm not interested in leaders like this. I'm interested in the law.
Right.
I need the law to protect my rights, not the goodness of a man. I don't care who the hell he is.
No.
His comment really disturbs me. It's like, well, no. When did we shift over to a total cult of personality where I got to hope that one man can make a right decision? No, that's not how this country is supposed to function as a democracy. And no one's calling him on it. You know, are they being called left-wing loonies if they support the Fourth Amendment? You understand what I mean?
Absolutely. Yeah.
And
we're all crazy.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
We're all crazy. We're all crazy. The far left fringe.
Yeah, but see, that doesn't mitigate what is actually going on here. Surveillance state, like you said, or who knows what's coming down the pike. When they give immunity for these corporations on this, it's going to lead to immunity for them to do other things, like you said, pollute. You know, it's just a horrible precedent. I can't even believe that this is going on, and it's being covered over by this, we need to have some sort of energetic executive? I think he has plenty of energy. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah. And it's just, you know, okay, let's give Obama the benefit of the doubt here. I'll be a good president, and I won't do anything like that. Okay, Obama, what if we get another Nixon? What if we get another Junior Bush after that? How do we trust them?
No, the whole premise is so antithetical to what this sort of republic is supposed to be. You need laws, because you can't rely. You know, Madison say he designed the system so that devils could run it, really, and it still is supposed to function.
Right.
Because you can't trust men.
That's exact. There you go. There you go.
And it's just, you know, I'm so, you know, I mean, I don't care if they're calling Glenn Greenwald, these other people, lunatics now. They're completely right. I don't see anything flawed in what he's saying. What I see flawed is Obama becoming a craven politician right before our eyes. That's what I'm tripping on.
Oh, Sandra, I hate it. I hate it. You brought that up, and I'm so sorry to say that I agree with you.
Well, I'm not. You know, listen. I am. I've never been one to be. We've talked about this before. Obama's great and all that, what he's doing, but I'm not. You know, I'm too old and jaded to be bowled over by speeches and pretty words and whatever.
Yep.
I am done with that. I want someone competent, but I want it backed by the law and co-equal branches. I don't know what the hell we got now. You know, it's really changing, you know, this country. The surveillance state is very frightening to me.
Co-equal branches? What a novel idea.
Well, no, but it's this sort of select, yeah, I don't know, you know, what to make of it.
Do you have, let me interrupt you, do you have, do you have any idea, do you have any thoughts on why the legislative branch seems so willing to go along with this imperial presidency and give them all the power?
Well, outside of it being easy, you know, for them, there's also the possibility that these people who we're electing for Congress are really, they don't understand how this government works anymore. You
Man.
Know, they don't read laws. They pass laws without reading them. They just adhere to the party above all else. You know, all of it is really sort of ass backwards. I don't mean to go back to Madison, but he also was he feared factions. Well, he would be in total terror
if
he was alive now.
Oh, yeah.
Factions are what is, you know, being a problem here. I don't know.
The founders right now, I'm Fred, if you read them some of this stuff and they were sitting at a meeting place, their heads would snap. They wouldn't know what to think because we're so far off the mark on some of this stuff right now that it wouldn't be even recognizable to them.
Well, no, and it's just like you said just a few minutes ago, this week would show Obama as, you know, what kind of man he was, and the man has come down on everything. I can't believe some of the things he's against this, not executing people for, the child rape.
Yeah.
I'm disturbed by that because I think that child rape is awful. But if you're going to have I thought murder was the base, you know, you kill people who murder people. Now we're going to raise the bar to where a capital offense becomes this. Then what? Burglary?
Yeah.
Saudi Arabia is what we become real quick here.
Sure, sure.
So I'm glad they did that decision, but I'm disturbed by his comments. I mean, who is he trying to speak to now?
Well,
he got the
as many as possible. That's what it's about, gathering in as many voters as possible, and we're in that mode, I guess. I don't know. Do you think anybody that's honest could get elected anymore? Do you think anybody could stand up and speak their mind and stand for their principles could get elected? I kind of wonder.
Well, I I'm not going to just write the guy off.
No, me either.
I have to say that, you know, this isn't really boding well for his presidency. And the main thing that's disturbing me is this "I'll be good." That scares me because that don't mean crap, guy.
No.
If you don't have laws to restrain you and the Pfizer thing, I hate how they're trying to make it out as if this is some sort of net root concern and nobody else really cares.
Right, right.
I don't believe that because I don't believe that most Americans want corporations to have immunity. Trust me, if you ask any American walking down the street, they would say no, they don't want corporations to be above the law. Am I wrong?
I'd rather give the mafia immunity.
Yeah, please. You know what I'm saying? These corporations are like, you know, having such a deleterious effect on our lives as is, and now it's just fascist.
Hey, we're finding out what the largest corporation would do to us right now, aren't we? We're finding out.
No, and it's really, I don't know. I don't know what to make of it all, but anyway, I just, I'll let you go.
Hey, thanks for your good call. I appreciate your thoughts, And I think we're in agreement. I think Barack lost some of his shine to me today and yesterday, and I hope he can and bring it back.
Okay. Take care.
Hey, thanks for the call.
Bye.
We're gonna pause for a break right now and get ready for our guest coming up here in just a moment or two, and we'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
John McCain has done more than just embrace George Bush's failed policy in Iraq. It's actually his idea to escalate the war there. It's John McCain's idea to send tens of thousands more soldiers to Iraq and to keep them there with no timeline for bringing them home. The McCain plan to escalate, going from bad to worse.
Hey,
For joining us here this afternoon on the Guy James Show. As promised, we have a guest with us right now that I've been looking forward to talking to for quite a while. We've got Michael Waldman on, got a new book out called A Return to Common Sense, and that says it all about this book. Michael Waldman is the director of the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University School of Law. It's a great common sense book, and he also was a head speechwriter, director of speechwriting for Bill Clinton, wrote several of his State of the Union speeches and inaugural addresses. So, Michael, welcome to the show.
Oh, my pleasure.
Great book, Common Sense, very, very, very good book to read, and I just finished it up last night. And I don't think I've ever seen better timing for a book. Your book absolutely nails 7 ways to really cure what's ailing the nation right now.
Well, that's very kind of you to say that. I think the elections coming on really brings into sharp focus both the hopeful things we see, but also the ways we've got to strengthen our democracy if we're going to make it work.
Well, you've listed 7 ways to do it in there, and let's start with the election process. You pretty much state that the entire process is badly broken, and we know we've had numerous problems in the past couple of presidential elections with voting machines of the electronic type and all. And I know the Brennan Center, which the director, has formed a task force to look into the electronic voting machine problem. What are the results of your study of this so far?
Well, you're exactly right. You know, when we all learned in Florida in 2000 that it's not as simple as it seems, that the way we cast and count votes in this country really isn't very effective sometimes. And we had every reason to hope things would get better, but they haven't gotten better nearly as much as they should have. One of the things that did happen was states moved to electronic voting all over the country. And that's not bad necessarily, but a lot of people are worried that it's insecure, that you could hack the machines, that votes won't be counted accurately. We convened some of the top computer scientists from inside and outside the federal government to say, so, you know, look at these machines, look at these systems, what do you think? And the scientists came back and said that every single one of them was woefully insecure. I always say that when it comes to voting, even paranoids have enemies. And that was the bad news. The good news is there are things that could be done to fix them, and I think a lot of them people might be familiar with, basically the most important of which is a paper record, so that the voter can kind of check their vote against what the machine shows. And there has to be auditing also to make sure that those paper records match what winds up in the final total. But those are the kinds of changes that can be made. Unfortunately, very few states have done all the things that need to be done. There's been real progress in a lot of places, but we still have a long ways to go to make sure that the electronic systems are fully secure.
You don't think people are cynical enough like me to think that the thing could shoot you out a paper saying one thing and record something else?
Well, that's why the audits are important, because without an audit, you know, it's just a piece of paper that's not worth very much. But if you have basically people checking the machines and saying, wait a minute, we've checked the machine, and this one here is supposed to have 25 votes for this candidate, 30 votes for that candidate, but it looks like all the votes for a different candidate, there's something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
With those kind of audits, you can't ever make things foolproof completely, but you can certainly make it much better. I mean, let's not forget that the good old days weren't so great. In 2000, we lost apparently 2 million votes nationwide due to errors in the counting and problems with voter lists. And that was before electronic voting.
So, yeah, and so one remembers the
Garden of Eden.
One remembers the days of Boston and Chicago and the Daily Machine and ballot boxes. Let me ask you just the simplest of questions. I'm a very simplistic guy. Is it not possible anymore to go in and put an X on a candidate's name behind a paper and put them in a ballot box and then just count them later? Maybe it'll take 2 or 3 days. Are there no big societies in the world that do that anymore?
You know, some places do that, and the problem is that the counting often then is imprecise, or that makes it easier to stuff the ballot box. But one of the kinds of electronic systems that you see all around the country is what's called optical scan, and that's close to that. It's sort of basically like, if you people who've taken standardized tests in school where you kind of fill a box, you know, with a pencil next to the name you want.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much what a lot of these electronic machines do. It's just they have a computer reading it rather than a person. And so that may be the best of all. And a lot of states have those kinds of machines. And, I think that those are more and more likely going to be the ones that people are going to have.
As far as registering voters in this country, it's such a big problem. And why is it such a problem? Is much of the problem because both of the parties have made it intentionally difficult in one place or another to benefit themselves?
Well, our voter registration system is one of the most restrictive in the world. That's according to Jimmy Carter and Gerald Ford, former presidents, obviously, of both parties. And they studied it, and they said this is one of the reasons we have some of the lowest voter turnout rates in the world. Now, hopefully this year voting will be up, but we still have a long way to go. And part of it is that it's kind of a slapdash system. There's different rules all over the place. Voting is really run by counties or by states. It's certainly no national standard. But you also have the fact is that a lot of these rules were put in place 100 years ago to keep former slaves and Irish immigrants who were in the cities from easily voting. And we're still living with that system. So one of the things that I talk about in this book, Return to Common Sense, is that it's common sense to have universal voter registration, basically to say that every adult citizen who is eligible to vote gets to vote. Their name's on a list. The government keeps the list. Government has all different kinds of ways of assembling the lists of eligible people. If you don't want to be on the list, you can take your name off the list. But if you register once, you ought to be able to stay registered even if you move from place to place, which is one of the main reasons people aren't on the voter rolls. They just fall off the rolls when they move. All these ways we could build a more modern system, and that would add up to 50 million people to the voter rolls.
Mm.
And I do think that a lot of the reforms I talk about in this book, they pretty much all pull in the same direction, which is not trying to purify politics or cleanse it of its imperfections, but more participation, more citizen involvement is better.
Absolutely.
We're always better off when we trust people to have more power in their own hands.
Absolutely, I agree. And one of those things you talked about is doing away with the Electoral College. I think it's time to put that out of its misery, don't you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the Electoral College, you know, the reason we have an Electoral College in the first place is they couldn't really figure out at the Constitutional Convention, they couldn't really figure out how to pick the president. But it really didn't seem to matter all that much because they all knew George Washington was going to be the president anyway. So they came up with the Electoral College, and they went on to other things. And four times in the country's history, obviously most recently in 2000, four times, the person who came in second nonetheless won, got to be president even though they didn't get the most votes. That's in a year, and that almost happened, by the way, in 2004.
Yeah.
George W. Bush beat John Kerry by 2 million votes nationwide, but Kerry, if a few thousand votes had gone differently in Ohio, Kerry would have been president. And I suspect a lot of Republicans would have found that to be illegitimate if that had happened. So that's one of the reasons the Electoral College is a problem. But even in a year where it works well, in the sense that the right guy wins, it sends politics in the wrong direction, because this just winds up being a handful of swing states who get all the campaigning and all the attention. And, you know, everyone was very excited about the primaries, that everyone was voting in all these places. South Dakota had a campaign, Indiana. But you know what? In the general election, it's going to be back to the handful of states. So, you know, we could eliminate the Electoral College by a constitutional amendment. That's pretty hard to do. But there's actually a way to bypass it. If states agree with one another that they will vote their electors for whoever wins the national popular vote, as long as enough other states do the same. And that's called national popular vote, and it's been passed now in a bunch of states, big states, including Illinois and New Jersey and Maryland and other places. And the fact of the matter is, it would change politics again, because you would see candidates appealing to all the voters, not just those in swing states.
What objection would any state have for being in the national popular vote program?
Well, if you're in a swing state, you might like the current system.
Yeah, okay.
I don't know that I don't find there to be too many strong, plausible objections. I don't think it's a partisan thing. Although this was in California, it actually passed the legislature, although Governor Schwarzenegger vetoed it, which I was sort of surprised. And there may be some partisan ramification that I don't understand, but the person pushing this the hardest is a Republican, John Anderson. So, it just strikes me that what you would have is both a state like California that's Democratic, or a state like Texas that's Republican. Right now they don't see the candidates very much. It's not small states, it's not big states, it's just swing states.
Right.
Get all the attention right now.
Michael, I know you're pressed for time. I have one question I have to ask you. I just have to ask you, being a speechwriter for President of the United States, and I suppose the answer to this depends on the president, but when you sit down to write a State of the Union address or an inaugural address, how much latitude do you have with that and the content and everything? Are you given an outline and say, here, take it?
Well, you're exactly right that it really certainly does depend on who the president is. In my own case, I worked for Bill Clinton. He was very, very involved, as you can imagine, in the writing of his own speeches. For a State of the Union address, they would go through sometimes 20, 25 drafts. And with him, we would sit down, we would go over an outline. By the end, at the beginning of his presidency, things were a little chaotic. By the end, it was pretty smooth. He would sort of dictate an outline, and we would know which themes he wanted to use. And in Clinton's case, he liked to reach out to literally dozens of people, both the cabinet secretaries and outside thinkers and writers. But then we would sit down, and the writers do have a lot to say about what goes into a speech. But in Clinton's case, he would rewrite and rewrite and make it his own. You know, different presidents do it different ways. And I think that President George W. Bush, by all accounts, he pretty much reads what the writers hand him.
I pretty much think that he gets that baby handed to him as he's walking up on the podium.
Well, you know, and you've gotten a situation where, by all accounts, the Axis of Evil was written by the speechwriters because it sounded good.
Mm-hmm.
And then that became the foreign policy of the United States, and we had to live with it.
Yeah.
After he got up there, President Bush said, there's an Axis of Evil. Iran and Iraq, two countries that hate each other, Iran and Iraq and North Korea. And I called a friend of mine who also wrote for President Clinton the next day, and I said, how come nothing you wrote ever got a million people out on the streets of Tehran?
Michael, I want to thank you so much for being on the program today. A great book, The Return to Common Sense. It's available everywhere. Michael Waldman, director of the Brennan Center for Justice. Michael, it's been a pleasure to have you on. I could talk to you for a couple of hours, I know, very, very easily. You're an interesting guy, and I hope you continue on with your good work that you do. And again, that book's available just everywhere, isn't it? Amazon and all over.
Yes, it is.
And it's Resource Books, and one of our favorite publishers here at the show. Michael Waldman, thank you so much for being on the program today.
Thank you.
Good book, Return to Common Sense. You'll like it. He's got some great ideas in there, and boy, the stories he could tell about writing speeches for the President of the United States. And like he said, like I mentioned to him, it does pretty much depend on which president you're writing for. Clinton, I'm sure it'd be a whole lot easier to write. Well, I don't know. Maybe it's more difficult when the president's got input. If someone like Junior Bush comes up and says, he opens up your office door and says, hey, I need me a speech today or tomorrow sometime. Give me a speech. I think it's supposed to be about the economy or something. I don't know. But just get me one together. And, that probably would be better. That way you could just sit in there and write out a speech. Because, of course, if you're a speechwriter, you're a hell of a lot more qualified to write a speech than Junior Bush would ever be. So you could just sit down there and write out a nice speech and print it out and hand it to him. There you go, boy. I think that's the thing. So that's a question I did want to ask Michael, but I think I've come up with my own answer for that. Don't you think? I think it's easier to write a speech if you got a bozo for a president than it would be Bill Clinton that comes back and says, "No, let me rephrase that a little bit and let's put this over here." And yeah, that's probably what it is. 866-546-5254, 866-546-5254. I did want to talk a lot today about, and by the way, I was talking about common sense. I got this great note from one of our loyal listeners, Stuart. And I, as you know, I've been talking about nationalizing oil companies. And how people are ragging on me pretty hard about that. And Stuart writes, Bloomberg TV had an interview with Obama. He was at an economic summit in Pittsburgh for a couple of days, meeting with business leaders, and the interviewer said that Rick Wagoner, the CEO of GM, said that the one way the government could help the auto industry is to provide a lot of R&D dollars for new technology. Isn't it interesting how the conservatives have conniptions? There's a word that I used to use a lot, and I haven't heard that in a while. Conservatives have conniptions about the free market when you suggest something about nationalizing of oil, but they have no problem with GM asking the government and taxpayers to pay for research so that they can claim the profits later and say they shouldn't be taxed because that's how the free market works. Why wouldn't they have conniptions about these industries being subsidized? Why is one socialism and the other not? I think if the taxpayers is going to subsidize, invest, and bail out, they have a right to expect a return and not just some vague promise about jobs. These free market versus socialism framework is distorted and simplistic. The interviewer also said that he just got news Obama was endorsed by the AFL-CIO, and he said to Obama, aren't the unions also responsible for the bad shape of the auto industry? And Obama said without hesitation that the auto executives who made bad decisions in the past are the ones who are responsible. Then he said they have better executives now who understand more of the issues. I thought that was a good answer. Didn't blame the workers, but complimented the current execs. It shows he understands who he stands with and who butters his bread, but also avoided insulting current executives because of an interviewer trap. That's what a good politician does. And he further writes, I've got a good comeback for you when you mention nationalization of oil to right-wingers. And Sir doesn't necessarily agree with me on nationalization of oil. I think the jury's still out on that with him. But he said, I have a comeback for you when you mention nationalization of oil to right-wingers and they get angry and ask you if you're a socialist. How about, well, I figured if there's a choice between a few oil companies owning the U.S. government and having the executives screw the public, or having the U.S. government owning a few oil companies and having the public screw the oil executives, I'd rather go for the latter. Or if I have a choice between a few oil companies owning the U.S. government or the U.S. government owning a few oil companies, I choose the second. Well, I wholeheartedly agree with that. And that is a good comeback. 866-546-5254, if you'd like to join us here on the program. I want to talk a lot about today, and I think I'll wait until the second hour to get started on that. I want to talk about this FISA bill, the telecom immunity, and the imperial presidency, and I want to talk about how that's not something that has just popped up during the Bush administration. It started a long time ago. And there have been a lot of presidents try to grab extra power. But Dickie Nixon probably got it started off the best, I imagine. I see our news today. Our news feed is been upset for some reason. I don't know what the problem is with that. The market is currently down 321 points. And oil is at $139.64. Oh, you're going to pay more tonight at the pump. I'm glad I got gas a couple of days ago. Maybe it was just, I forget. Got this story in the mail, and I wanted to tell you about it. Someone forwarded it to me. It's an article out of the New York Times by Tony Sinicola and Gail Collins. And it says, let's discuss the vice presidency. Maybe some of you have seen this. It's very, very interesting. David Brooks and Gail Collins discussed the 2008 presidential race. Who are Barack Obama and John McCain going to choose for their running mates? And boy, that's a good question. I just at this point don't have any idea. Do you? I wonder if either of them know full well who they're going to pick. Do you think one of them's really got one cut and dried already? I'll bet McCain does. Anyway, it says, I'm praying for McCain to select Mitt Romney so I can repeatedly revisit the time Mitt drove to Canada with a family dog on top of the station wagon roof. Or perhaps they could both pick Michael Bloomberg. If you're planning on discussing vice presidential hopefuls at an upcoming dinner party, the best bet is to propose a swing state governor no one's heard of. When it comes to a combination of experience and youth, I've got to go with Tim Pawlenty. Even if you're wrong, it'll impress the heck out of people. Vice presidents provide more interesting material for conversation than you might think, although most are best appreciated as random antidotes. For example, did you know that William King, Franklin Pierce's running mate, was the only bachelor vice president and that he lived for years with James Buchanan, the only bachelor president? I didn't know that until I got this. And then there was Charles Dawes, Calvin Coolidge's Veep, who wrote the melody of the song, It's All in the Game. You youngsters, maybe you know. Many a tear has to fall, but it's all in the game. And then he got a Nobel Peace Prize for his work on stabilizing the German economy after World War I. And then the last one didn't work out too well. The song's nice, though. And it's only fairly recently that the top of the ticket had a say in selecting a running mate. Presidential candidates used to stay home during the party convention, reacting with delighted surprise when word of their nomination arrived. The second spot was like one of those secret Santa gifts you receive from a fellow employee who doesn't know you very well. When Rutherford B. Hayes first got word that he was going to be hooked up with Representative William Wheeler of New York, Hayes said, "Who is Wheeler?" But you never know how these arranged marriages will work out. Hayes and his wife took Wheeler, a retiring widower who suffered from hypochondria, under their wings, and he wound up spending many a happy night sitting quietly in the corner of the White House parlor. Vice presidential handicappers have always given a lot of attention to geography. Although this makes no sense whatsoever, Americans aren't dumb enough to vote on the basis of which running mate is from their state. I may disagree with John McCain on every single point of policy, but he's got Tim Pawlenty on the ticket, and we both live in Minnesota. How cool is that? Sometimes the vice presidential selection will tell you what qualities the presidential nominee feels he lacks. George W. Bush, for instance, picked Dick Cheney because Cheney had experience, while Bush enjoyed baseball. Martin Van Buren, New Yorker, sort of chubby career politician, was the Democratic candidate when the party was looking for balance, and picked Richard Johnson, a colorful former Indian fighter from Kentucky. And in 1840, Van Buren was pitted against William Henry Harrison, whose claim to fame was defeating Tecumseh at the Battle of Tippecanoe. Johnson had actually, or at least allegedly, reputedly, and possibly killed Tecumseh in a later encounter. When a Whig said Tippecanoe and Tyler too, Van Buren's backers were supposed to say Rumpsy Dumpsy Colonel Johnson shot Tecumseh. That's true, by the way. They did not work out, that didn't work out all that well. Meanwhile, that Harrison-Tyler combo was the ultimate don't-ask-don't-tell ticket, since Harrison never said what he thought about anything, and no one ever asked Tyler his opinions. All the Whig leaders knew that it was a wonderful balancing act, since Tyler was a Virginia slave owner, and Harrison was a northerner who was maybe possibly opposed to slavery. Imagine the Whig surprise when Harrison died a few weeks after the inauguration, and it turned out that Tyler disagreed with virtually the entire party program, public works plan included. As voters, all we need in a vice presidential nominee is a man or woman qualified to run the store in the event of a crisis, on more or less the same lines as the person at the top of the ticket. Other than that, picking a running mate is, no disrespect intended, like picking a pet. How much time are you planning on spending with the little fellow? How much exercise will he be getting on the average day? On one extreme, you have the William Wheeler model. There's the living room. Go find a corner and sleep in it. On the other end, there's the Cheney version, in which the pet takes over the checkbook, diversifies the family investment portfolio, and starts strafing at the neighbor's cat. I think I speak for all of us when I say that something in the middle would be nice. The Al Gore model. Unfortunately, Gore's vehement insistence that he's not interested in being on the Obama ticket suggests that he didn't enjoy the vice presidency all that much. Maybe the Nobel Peace Prize has gone to his head. I wonder if he's ever heard of Charles Dawes. And that's a pretty interesting story about the vice presidency. 866-546-5254. Where are we at here on time? Did you know North Korea's not evil anymore? We were talking to Michael about this axis of evil. Did you know North Korea's off the terrorist list? They're not part of the axis of evil? I tell you, that's just absolutely amazing. He throws away the agreement that Bill Clinton had with the North Koreans upon assuming the office, puts them on the Axis of Evil list as a terrorist list, negotiates with them for 7 years, and ends up back signing another agreement like Bill Clinton had signed with them and that they had trashed in the first place, and then wants credit for it. If you can figure out this administration sometime, let me know. I see the market's down, 338 points. Oil's still at 139.64, so, wow. I read someplace last night, and I should get the stats on this. Accounting for the dollar being so low right now, and inflation and all, that the market really, and don't quote me on this, but I think taking those into account, inflation and the lowering of the dollar, I think the market's worth somewhere around 30% less than it was when Junior took over. Does that sound right? Pretty sure that's the story I saw. Taking the lumps today. Who knows where it'll end up? They've got 2 minutes to trade yet, and they get pretty crazy at the end sometime. We're really off schedule today due to the fact that our news feed is non-existent today for some reason. So we'll compensate for that. We'll do some music at the top of the hour for a couple of minutes to give your host a break, and we'll be back. Don't go away.
I'm not sure I could. They say time heals everything, but I'm still waiting. I'm through with doubt. There's nothing left for me to figure out. I've paid a price, and I'll keep paying.
This is the Guy James Show. Guy James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Welcome back to the show. Ah, yes. Just taking a look at the stock market. Ended up, what, 358 points down. Oil is at $139.139 per barrel. Oh, yes, indeed. What good news. The economy's going good, but we are not in a recession, you know. Do keep that in mind, and I don't want to mislead all of you folks, because oil is much higher than it's ever been, just because groceries are much higher than it's ever been, just because wages are down and unemployment is up and durable goods in the United States production is way down and our exports are down, all that happens to be doesn't mean we're in a recession, you see, because I watched the Business Channel last night and they said we weren't in a recession. So what the hell do I know? Only they know if it's a recession. 866-546-5254 if you'd like to join us here on the program today. Let me clarify something. I was emailing back and forth with a friend during the break we had, and I do want to clarify something. I did say the other day, I think on Tuesday, that we'd find out what kind of a man Barack Obama is this week. I should have been a little more specific when I said that. I should have said we'll find out what kind of a politician he is. I know Barack Obama's a good man. I didn't mean we're going to find out if he's a good man or a bad man. I know damn well he's a good man. I know he is. I mean, I don't know him personally, but I've met him a couple of times, but I'm pretty sure he's been adequately vetted, although now the righties are hunting down his birth certificate. They don't think he was born in the U.S. legally or something. All the right-wingers are going crazy over that. But I believe he is a good man. I guess what I should have said, we'll find out what kind of a politician he is. Let me explain something about myself, and if for any of you that know me, you will find out that I'm somewhat of a hard ass. You'll find out that I'm somewhat of a purist. You will find out there are many cases in my life where I have cut off my nose to spite my face just because I stood for something and I wouldn't back down. And that's cost me. That's cost me, and it costs anybody who does that. But I have a certain set of principles that I try very, very hard not to violate. Not saying I never have, but I try oh so hard. And my sense of loyalty to certain people and all that, I just won't. That's why, in my opinion. And you know, so let me get sidetracked here. I know politics. I know what politics is about, and I know it's about compromise and shifting positions and all that. I know that. I know the realities of politics, and there are some of the realities of politics that I don't appreciate. And when I say I have a set of principles and I try and stick to them, it doesn't mean I'm a perfect guy, but if there's something I really and truly believe in, hard and fast, I'm not going to give that up. And I'm not gonna say something to one person and something else to another person in order to be friends with both of them. I'll have the same position no matter who I talk to. And that's why some of the tactics of politicians and some of their strategies are abhorrent to me. I cannot do that. I can't talk out of both sides of my mouth. I can't go to one person and say I believe this and go to another person and say I believe that. I can't do it. And I know Barack Obama has made statements about the FISA bill, most specifically the telecommunications part of it. And I know he's made different statements to different people at different times. And I don't like that. I don't have to like that. And I will never like that. Of Barack Obama, of Bill Clinton, of Hillary Clinton, of Franklin Roosevelt, or from anybody. I understand the realities of it. I do. But I'm enough of a dreamer, I'm enough of a purist in this, that I keep thinking that someday we can elect a president who actually gets elected on his principles, on his, from his heart, on the stands that he's taken and the tenets that he's followed his entire life, without drifting away from them whatsoever. I'm enough of an idealist to think that someday we might actually find somebody like that. And I know I'm dreaming, and I do recognize the realities of it, but I don't like that part of it. And I've seen that ugly part of it, and many of you have as well. And I've experienced it up close and personal. So, I just wanted to explain that. I don't mean that I think Barack Obama's a bad guy, because I don't. And I'm going to vote for Barack Obama. Unless that I find out that he's a space alien that roasts and eats babies every night, he'll get my vote. I just thought I'd explain that. That's the problem with me. I know a couple of other people like me, and we've talked about this, that you know, your hard ass views sometimes get you in trouble. Well, I'm sorry, but that's how it is. So that's my confession, my admission for today. I am highly upset that Barack Obama wouldn't go along with stripping the telecommunications part out of the FISA bill. Maybe it changes his mind. There were 15 Democrats that had the cojones to go ahead and stick to their principles, and there's probably other things involved there with them, even their electability in their areas. Of course, some of them are pretty doggone safe, but I know one. I'll tell you this much right now. Sherrod Brown, senator from Ohio, I know Sherrod. And I'll tell you what, when he voted to stick together with the 15, he was doing it possibly at his political peril. But he's a guy that wouldn't change his mind on it. I can tell you that about Sherrod Brown right now. He did not change his mind on that for political gain. And that could even hurt him in Ohio eventually. But he's the kind of guy who would say, damn it, I don't care. I have to vote what I think is right. I have to do what I think is right, not just to get elected. And like I've said all too many times on this program, if we let this slip and that slip, and if we let this disingenuousness overtake our government, and we let the lies and the law breaking and all that go on, and if we change our positions to follow any poll that happens to be out there, and our personal principles go by the wayside, if we do get elected as president of the United States, what are we president of? Is it a country any longer? If that's the way we do things, if we're willing to forgo right and wrong and just willy-nilly go at anything, no matter, just follow the winds, whichever way the political winds are blowing, if we're willing to do that, and if the country becomes like that, and that's what we are as a nation, and we get ourselves elected, we manage to get elected, what are we president of? Is it worth it? That's my speech for today. I didn't mean to lecture you, but that's just how I feel about it. How many of you know about the Houston plan? You know about the Houston plan? Anybody old enough besides me to know what it is? Look it up. Look it up on Wikipedia or one of those places like that. Google it, the Houston plan. It was a 43-page report and outline of proposed security operations put together by this aide they had in the White House back in 1970 during Nixon's time. His name was Tom Houston. And nobody knew about this whole thing, this Houston plan, until the Watergate thing started up and old Sam Irvin, good old boy from North Carolina, got involved. Anybody remember Sam Irvin? What a guy. Anyway, all of this came about, this Houston plan, was because Dickie Nixon wanted to spy on people. And that was it, plain and simple. And they had this group called the ICI. It was Interagency Committee on Intelligence, and J. Edgar Hoover well, was ahead of it. And this Houston, this Tom Houston out of the White House, he worked with Hoover's assistant, and they drew up this plan. And what it was a plan for domestic spying on people here in the United States. Illegal electronic surveillance, opening people's mail, going after the people they consider to be radicals. They actually planned to build some detainee camps out in the western states where the anti-war protesters would be kept. I don't know if it's actually in the Houston plan, but Nixon and, well, I don't know if Nixon was himself was in on this personally. He was in on the Houston plan. But on this, all of a sudden I can't think of his name, involved in Watergate, they actually planned on blowing up part of the Department of Justice and blaming it on radicals. So they could go in and steal some documents and all that. And Nixon was a dirty guy, and his most of the people with him were dirty people, most of them, not all of them. And they were willing to do anything. The point being here, that here was a president that decided that if the president said it, it was legal. And you get where I'm going with this, because we've got another guy now that says if the president does it, it's legal. And Nixon actually said that in wartime, a president does have certain extraordinary powers which would make acts that would otherwise be unlawful, lawful if undertaken for the purpose of preserving the nation and the Constitution, which is essential for the rights we're all talking about. Dick Nixon said that. That's a direct quote from Nixon. So, in time of war, he's got these powers to protect us, and he can break the laws. And my point here is to go further with this and say that that was the start, essentially the start, of a more than 30-year campaign by the White House to grab more and more and more power away from the legislative branch. And I don't understand why the legislative branch has gone along with it, but they have consolidated a lot of power in the White House over these years, and it's a lot of people thought that this was going on just because Dick Nixon was nuts. They thought all this was just sort of a little wild dream game of Dickie Nixon. Thought he was crazy, unhinged, and all that. It wasn't based on just some crazy president's whim. It's something that the Republican Party has aimed for over the past, well, I don't know, 40 years almost. And when you stop and think about it, you know it's true. We had the Iran-Contra. We have the acts, the many illegal acts of the Bush administration. So this isn't any little happenstance here. This is something that's been acted out and planned on for a long time by these neocons. And the point is that they've gone on and on and on with it, and they've grabbed a little power here and a little more power there, and they've gotten a little more, done a few more illegal acts here and a few more there, to the point where the Congress has become jaded or completely compliant and gone along with anything they want to do, particularly on the Republican side. Don't ask me why it's mostly the Republicans that way. One would think in political parties and political power, and where power is the big prize, that both parties would try to do this, but they have not. Well, Roosevelt tried a couple of things to get a little extra power, tried to pack the Supreme Court and all. But my big question in all this is, How long, if ever, will it take to turn this back? Will the legislative branch be inclined to turn it back? Will they be inclined to push back and push back hard? Will the executive branch, no matter who the president may be inclined to allow the legislative branch to once again become a co-equal branch of government? I wonder, is it out of the box now and it can't be put back in? The genie's out of the bottle and it'll never go back? When you stop and think about the egomania and the desire for power by many of the politicians, one would think that perhaps this power will never be yielded back. That's entirely possible, that it'll never be yielded back, that we'll never have a president with enough, enough ethics, enough love for the Constitution of the United States, and a big enough understanding for the Constitution of the United States as it relates to the people. I don't know. If we have a president like that, they should yield the power back to the president, back to the legislative branch, and have them once again be co-equal. But I can't see it happening. I really cannot see it happening. And this authoritarian type regime that we have in now has worked this to their advantage, and they've broken many laws. And now it's come to the point where it's come right out in the open with this telecom immunity bill, that we know there isn't any doubt whatsoever that the President of the United States and his administration have broken the law. Wantonly and openly, they have broken the laws of the United States. They've gone against the Constitution of the United States of America. And now we're finding that the legislative branch does not have the guts to do anything about it. My answer, my question is why? Why not let this be the line in the sand where the legislative branch, the Congress of the United States, doesn't draw the line in the sand and say enough? Enough. This will not stand. I don't understand. I don't get that. And that's why I'm disheartened when I see Barack Obama say, the bill has changed, so I don't think the security threats have changed. I think the security threats are similar. My view on FISA has always been that the issue of the phone companies per se is not one that overrides the security interest of the American people. So where do we draw the line? We've now allowed... And don't get your hopes up, because this baby's over with. The 80-15 cloture vote last night, that's all you need to know. That was the vote on this. So don't think it's going to change, because it's a million to one shot that it's going to change. They've said, Mr. Bush and friends, it's okay if you break the law. It's okay. We'll let you do it. I feel really bad about that. I do. I really do. And I've got a lot more to say about it as well, but and about the money involved. Odd how people's votes can be changed for a few grand. Set on over to the phone. Hi, you're on the Guy James Show. Hello? Let's try it again. Hello, you're on the Guy James Show.
Hey, Guy, it's Kevin.
Hi, Kevin.
A few days in a row.
How are you doing today?
Yeah, in defense of Barack, you have to understand the predicament, and he's doing very much a balancing act. He cannot come off too far to the left.
That's not a defense, that's an excuse.
Excuse, but, you know... Roosevelt had to do the same thing when he ran.
I know. They all play the game, and I hope I explained it well. I know the game.
Yeah. And you have to understand the military-industrial complex and corporatism is so entrenched in D.C. When you're running for office, you cannot be too much against it. Even a Kennedy can't afford to do it right now in this political climate.
I know. I understand it. I understand the nuts and bolts of the whole thing. I do. I just, I'm sad.
I know it's disappointing. I'm hearing all these talk show hosts. Tom Hart said the same thing. A lot of people are saying the same thing. But, you know, unfortunately, it's like what I like to call, you know, and it's something a lot of men of color, regardless of whatever, you could be a billionaire, goes through. It's called the Uncle Tom. And this is one of them. You know, we all have to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. I just, I don't know. I've never run for the presidency of the United States, so I would not know the exact predicament he's in, but I've had choices in my life to make, and not nearly as important in that
not
one.
Not everyone can be an Atticus from Kill a Mockingbird. we all cannot.
I know. It's disturbing to a hard head like me. It is.
Yeah, it is too. But I always, you know, again, unfortunately, you know, we're in that climate where you cannot deviate. And I think this is the game as a party that the Democrats, at least I hope this is the game that the Democrats are playing.
Well, it's why all of this is why that politicians are held in lower esteem than used car salesmen. It is why, you know, tell you, hey, brand new tires on this baby, and it's all been tuned up and ready to roll, all new belts and hoses, and a little old lady drove it on Sundays, and knowing that it's a complete pile of crap, and awful, same thing.
Well, the hardest thing to do is steal from a thief.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
And I think that's what he's trying to do in his own. Yeah, and again, it goes back to what I said yesterday. Everything this guy does is being monitored. Oh, they had a front page story on what kind of music he likes.
Yeah, I saw that. Have you seen this flap about his birth certificate?
No.
Yeah, it's circulating on the right wing websites about. Where was his mother actually when he was born? What does the birth certificate in Hawaii actually say? It's not legit. It's been photoshopped.
The last time I know, I had nothing to do with filling out my birth certificate. But, you know, hey, I could be wrong. Maybe I did. I forgot about it in a drunken phase.
They're claiming the whole thing was changed somehow to make it look like he's a natural-born citizen when he wasn't. That's the claim.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
How do you count for Schwarzenegger? That's a different story.
Yeah, well, he can't run for the presidency, but...
they're trying to make him.
Yeah, Orrin Hatch wants to change that. Orrin Hatch wants to change that.
Yeah.
I don't know why Orrin Hatch is on that bandwagon, but he's...
Because that's not... You see, the Republican Party, like the Democratic, and this is the one thing I agree with Bader, they're both corporations.
Oh, yeah.
And it's about the corporate answering to the corporation at the end of the day.
Yeah, I'm one of those ones that Walt Disney should make the movie for me if he was still alive and say, well, we're all going to live in land of milk and honey and everybody's going to tell the truth and the government forget the corporations, we're going to make this for the people, of the people, by the people, and for the people again, and all that. And I just, you know, one of those dreams you would have, and just hope we're in a utopia. But it's not that way. It's not going to be that way. But I keep on hoping. I do.
It's time in Florida. You need to come up north a bit.
Yeah, well, it's hurricane season. I don't want to get too carried away here. Yeah, we're 26 days into hurricane season.
Well, nothing bad so far.
Nothing yet. Yeah. Hey, thanks for calling. Good to hear
from
you.
No problem.
Yeah.
No problem. Bye.
More on this FISA thing, and then I'll get off of it. I know you get bored with it, but we had a lot of people comparing Democrats' votes March 14th and June 20th, okay? Verizon and Sprint and AT&T gave PAC contributions averaging $8,359 to each Democrat who changed their position to support immunity for the telecos, 94 of them. $4,987 to each Democrat who remained opposed. So they got the guys that voted with the telecoms got twice as much as the people who didn't. Out of all the House members, Verizon, AT&T, and Sprint gave PAC contribution averaging $9,600 to each member of the House voting yes for immunity, and half of that to those voting no. What a coincidence. The one getting the most for the telecoms, who changed their vote to support the telecos, James Clyburn, South Carolina, $29,500. Steny Hoyer, $29,000. These are people that changed their vote. Rahm Emanuel, $28,000. Frederick Boucher of Virginia, $27,500. Gregory Meeks, $26,000. Nancy Pelosi, $24,500. And I could go on and on and on. John Spratt, $18,500. I'm talking about people that a lot of you know here. You don't suppose that's just a coincidence, do you? I hope it is. I hope it is. But the point of all of it is, be afraid, be very afraid. If you're afraid enough, we can run over you all we want to. We can pass any illegal law. We can do anything illegal you want if you are afraid enough. So I want to play for you the Republican platform. I got the Republican talking points this morning on what their platform is this year. And it sounds remarkably similar to their platform of the last couple of presidential elections. But here's the Republican platform for this year.
In the heart of this great city, we saw tragedy arrive on a quiet morning. September the 11th. September the 11th. September the 11th.
September 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 11th.
2001.
Saddam Hussein.
Saddam Hussein.
Saddam Hussein.
Saddam Hussein.
Saddam Hussein.
Saddam. Saddam. Saddam.
Saddam.
Saddam.
Saddam. Saddam.
Saddam. Saddam.
Saddam.
Saddam.
Saddam.
Saddam Hussein.
War and danger.
Continuing danger.
Hour of danger.
Very, very dangerous world.
A grave new threat.
Horrific acts of atrocities.
Murderous regimes
dedicating to killing us.
Tyranny and terror.
Slaughtered thousands.
Weapons of mass destruction.
Weapons of mass destruction.
Weapons programs.
The deadliest of weapons.
Terrible weapons.
Nuclear weapons.
Nuclear weapons.
Poison gas.
Torture chambers.
Mass graves.
Deadly technologies.
Radical ideology of hate.
Terror of threats.
Terror.
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 War on terrorism.
War against terrorism.
Global war on terror.
Global terrorism.
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 The evil terrorists.
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 Today's past 18, he was waiting for the bus and his army green sat down in a booth. Cafe there gave his order to a girl with a bow in her hair. He's a little shy, so she gave him a smile. And he said, would you mind sitting down for a while and talking to me? I'm feeling a little low. She said, I'm off in an hour and I know where we can go. So they went down and they sat on the pier. He said, I bet you got a boyfriend, but I don't care. I got no one to send a letter to. Would you mind if I sent one back here to you?
God, I'm not even a Southern boy, and I love the chicks. I always did. I felt so bad for them when they were taking all that heat several years ago when the war started. Well, screw all those people that burned their tapes and their CDs and all the stations that refused to play their music anymore. All they did was keep some great music from a lot of people. The chicks, I love the chicks, and I'm not even a big country fan. I mean, I like some country music. I do like quite a lot of it, as a matter of fact, the crossover stuff. But you know, Marty Robbins, that kind of thing. That's real country western music, Marty Robbins. But hey, I had a story that I wanted to tell you. I used to drive to Miami quite a bit from here and go across Alligator Alley, and on a good sunny day January or so, it's kind of like mating season for the gators, and the gators would get out of the canals along Alligator Alley, and it would sun themselves in the afternoon. You came back at like 3 o'clock in the afternoon while the gators would all be out of the water, and they'd be up sunning themselves on the bank. And if you could stop your car or whatever vehicle you're driving, you could stop it and you could walk down through the ditch and you could walk over and see these gators up close and personal, real close. But now before you get to thinking, gee, that guy's really really brave. No, there's big fence there, big nasty fence that these gators, they couldn't get at you. But I never wanted to tempt one of the really big ones. I mean, it was common to see them, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9 feet. But one of the really big monsters, you didn't want to tease them or anything like that, because I always had a feeling that one of those big mamas, one of those 11.5, 12 footers, could come right through that fence under it if they wanted to. Yeah. So I never tempted them up that close, but it was always interesting to see them. And they're these big beasts laying there, you know. Well, we had a story here, and I told you the story yesterday about U.S. Sugar over in Okeechobee, which is over the lake about halfway between here and the other coast. U.S. Sugar being sold out to the state so that they can be part of the conservation area of the Everglades. And there are alligators thick in Okeechobee and all the canals around there, as there are in a lot of the canals around here, too. And you don't have to go very far. In fact, not far from where the studio is. Maybe I could walk there in 20 seconds. We had a gator in that pond not too long ago. Had to have him removed. He got up to about 5 feet or so, I suppose, before they had him taken out of there. Anyway, this Casey Edwards, a young man by the name of Casey Edwards, he knows he's lucky to be alive after a terrifying encounter with an 11.5-foot alligator on Sunday. The 18-year-old from Okeechobee decided to go swimming in a canal when an enormous gator attacked him about halfway through his swim. Holding on to a buoy line for dear life, Edwards managed to poke the reptile in the eye as he was repeatedly pulled under the water. Finally, the alligator was driven off, but also departed with a souvenir, the young Edwards' left arm. The young man was pulled to safety by friends and underwent surgery at the local hospital, where he's been in satisfactory condition following the ordeal. Meanwhile, the Florida Fish and Wildlife Commission captured and killed the alligator, finding Edwards' undigested arm in the gator's belly. One official didn't sound particularly sympathetic to young Edwards' plight. He said that the people in the area know that the lakes and canals are filled with alligators who are not afraid of humans. That is true. They are not. So too bad for that young man, but I don't know what would make you go swimming in the in a canal or Lake Okeechobee, because you're just asking for it under those conditions, really are. Market took quite a dive today. We've talked about that. It took a hell of a dive, and it just nails down the point, for me anyway, is that we're far, far, far from out of the woods. This was a sobering day with people with a lot of money in the market, especially in the wrong places. We've had the Fed, the last 9, 10, 11 months, something like that, cutting the interest rate by at least what, three and a quarter, 3.5%. They've cut it now, and tried to bail out the this home loan business and all that, and it's not working. When you stop and think about it, we're worse off now than when the Fed started all this bailout business. We're worse off now than when they started lowering the interest. And it does make one wonder, has this been effective, or would we be in just as bad shape? Would we be in worse shape if the Fed hadn't acted and cut the interest and done the bailouts? I wonder. But it is it's to the point where, you know, this credit crisis has still got Wall Street in a panic. We've reached a 21-month low on the stock market today. Bernanke didn't cut interest rates yesterday. The Fed didn't, because they said they're concerned about inflation. And this economy is struggling. It's really struggling. And even after cutting the rates to 3.25%, they've tried to tried to buttress this undercapitalized banking system, who are just being overwhelmed with bad loans tied to the housing bubble, and to also cushion the loss of consumer spending power tied to the falling house prices. A lot of people use their home for a bank, a piggy bank, you know, and they don't have any money to take out of them anymore. And you see companies like Citigroup today down 12% in one day. Goodyear Tire and Rubber down 11% in one day. Lear Corporation down 17%, and Rite Aid drug chain down 20%. Man, that's the economy for many of these people are just reeling, just absolutely reeling, and I don't know what the answer is. I most assuredly do not know what the answer is, but Oshkosh lost a third of its value, losing $830 million for its shareholders today after predicting high commodity costs are going to lead to a big third-quarter loss. Other decliners included automakers General Motors and Ford. Ford hit a low last seen back as far as 1985. So the gas price is killing the automobile manufacturers in this country, just killing them. And once again, I suppose, American automakers find themselves on the short end of the stick with vehicles that don't have good enough gas mileage, so like some of the foreign imports. And although I think they've tried hard to get back into the market to compete. And there are a lot of great American cars. There was a time back in the 70s and 80s, and the foreign cars were all the hot commodity. But and there's a lot of great foreign cars, don't get me wrong. But, man, there's a lot of great American cars right now, too. Fabulous American cars. I drool. I'm a car lover. And I drool over a lot of these cars I see. I'll always be a car lover. Who do people blame for all of this? 75% of the people in the latest Times and Bloomberg poll blame Bush's policies for deteriorating economy. 75%. Imagine that. What a great legacy he's going to leave with. Great legacy. And people will still vote for another Republican administration, a third Bush administration, after 75% of the people blaming him for the deteriorating economy. 9% of the people in the poll said the economic condition have improved. Now, they didn't ask him, is it improved for you? They've asked, has it for the country? Okay? That was the question. Is the country worse off or better off? And 9% of the people said the economic condition have improved since Bush became president. Now, what kind of a damn moron would you have to be Not for yourself personally, if you're some kind of a fat cat or you had great financial fortune for some reason during the Bush administration, but to answer a question, if the country's economic condition had have improved or declined, what kind of a moron would you have to be to say that the economic conditions in this country have improved since George Bush became the president? Oh, boy. Can you say knuckle dragger? Yeah. 75% said the conditions had worsened amongst Republicans. 42% said the country was worse off. 26% said it was about the same. Now, they're just about as damn dumb as that 9% said it was about the same. And 22% thought economic conditions have improved amongst Republicans. So, in other words, 48% of Republicans. Now, I'm just saying this to drive my point home. That I've always said, there's something the hell wrong with these people. Because 48% of Republicans, 48%, almost half of Republicans, say that the economy is about the same or better than it was when George Bush took over. Now, that says all you need to know right there about the people pulling the lever. Pulling the lever for the Republicans. Does it not? Half. This poll, lots of times, I'm not shocked by things, but this poll was shocking to me. That half the Republicans think the economy is the same or better since George Bush took over. It just staggers me that people could say that. They interviewed a whole bunch of people, and they gave their comments on here, and I won't go into a lot of their comments, but 79% of people with incomes of less than $40,000 a year said the high prices were a hardship. But so did 55% of respondents with the incomes above $100,000. And here's an interviewed a lady and said, oh, we've had to cut back on a lot of things. We can't go on camping trips. We're watching what we buy at the grocery store. And said, this year my kids probably won't be able to take swimming lessons because I can't afford it. Well, lady, I got an idea for you there, as far as regarding the swimming lessons. My dad, when I was about 6 years old, told me he was going to take me down to the pond and show me how to swim. He did. He threw me in, and I learned how to swim. So that's how you do swimming lessons. I always wondered for a long time after that how many times would he watch me go under before he didn't, you know. But I learned to swim that day. I did, and that's how I learned. If you got a swimming story like that, I swear to you it's true. It is. 82% of the respondents to this poll said the economy was doing badly, with only 71 who felt that way when it was asked back in February. So, it's a tough situation. And when you look at this market situation that happened today, it's just a further indication, folks, that things ain't good. And virtually nothing is being done to make them any better. I don't know what should be done to make them any better, but I know the status quo won't work. And the faster that Congress can get something together on these home loans, these predatory lenders, the faster that they can help bail out a few people that deserve to be bailed out, then let's get cracking on that. And let's get cracking on a solution to this high price of energy. Let's do something to cut down consumption. We have no serious efforts going on by the government at all. They're all just kind of floundering around, can't decide what to do, and well, we'll decide tomorrow. It's to the crisis stage, don't you think? It is to me. Well, it's been another good day here at the show. I always appreciate you listening in. Very, very much. Speaking of crisis situations, I do want to remind you once again that This is a listener-supported program, and we could most certainly use some assistance right now. We got a lot of things we'd like to do with the show, and we cannot because of lack of funds. So if you can chip in a couple of bucks, we'd appreciate it very, very much. And you can do so by heading on over to theguyjamesshow.com, and PayPal's on there. And thanks to all the people who do contribute. We get a check in the mail once in a while, and we have some PayPal subscriptions once in a while and one-time donors. And I'll have to read off that list again coming up here maybe next week. But we do so appreciate it. If it weren't for just a few of you, if it weren't just for a small percentage of you, the show would not be here. I can tell you that right now. So I do appreciate very, very much the folks that help out with the program. I think that's about all we have today. I want to thank so much Billy Shears, our music director of the show. Billy does such a doggone good job picking out tunes. Billy and I are really in tune with one another on our music, and he and his wife, as I've mentioned before, are great people. Don't forget, we have we have Mark coming up next. I don't see Mark on the chat room yet, so I'm not exactly sure. But anyway, I will see all of you. I won't actually see you, you know, but I'll visit with all of you again coming up shortly, Tuesday. And in the meantime, I hope you have yourselves a fabulous weekend. Find something to do other than to go out and drive around. I don't think there's a whole lot of people doing that nowadays, but find something fun to do, you and the family. All of you just have yourselves a good old weekend, and I'll try and do the same. You're listening to the Guy James Show here on the Head On Radio Network, Billy Shears, music director. Thanks so much for joining us, and don't forget, you heard from the radical right. Now all that's left is the truth. Later, gang.